Welcome to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. I'm Steve Alexander, in for Orion Samuelson, and our buddy Max Armstrong will be along in just a few minutes as well. Let's begin on Wall Street, where equities closed mostly flat on Friday, taking a little bit of a breather from their most recent run at record levels. And investors are waiting to hear what President Trump has to say to Congress next week. Nothing that we haven't heard before is expected, according to Kim Forrest, who's senior equity analyst at Fort Pitt Capital. She does expect him to key on his proposals we've heard so much about already: tax reform, deregulation, and repealing Obamacare. However, experts are concerned that his timetable may not be feasible, given Congress's agenda already, including repealing Obamacare and a Supreme Court nomination. The president is set to speak to a joint session of Congress on Tuesday night. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was marginally higher, up about 6.25 points, at 20,816, another record. But for most of the trading session, the Dow was in the red. In fact, early on, was down over 100 points. The S&P 500 also in the red almost all the way to the end. It did close higher, 3 points, at 2367. And the NASDAQ also was in the red most of the way, and in the last half hour of trading, it rose as well, up about 8 points on the day at 5,844. For the week, the Dow was up 0.95%, the S&P 500 was up 0.69%, and the NASDAQ was up 0.11%. European stocks fell on Friday, with the Pan-European Stoxx 600 index declining by 0.75%. Traders there are concerned about U.S. trade policies and the impact on regional economies, and the heightened political risks in the United States and Europe have revived an appetite for some safe haven assets, and gold has become a popular investor's choice. Gold hit its highest level in 3.5 months on Friday as the dollar fell to a one-week low, after the new U.S. Treasury Secretary poured cold water on the Trumpflation trade that had boosted the dollar this year. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said on Thursday in an interview with CNBC's Becky Quick that any steps the administration would take on policy would probably have only limited impact this year, though he wants to see tax reform passed by August. Mnuchin's comment on tax reform was the big takeaway by the media, but he talked about a lot of other things in a wide-ranging interview with Becky Quick of CNBC, who was kind enough to share it with us.
Steven Mnuchin is the new Treasury Secretary, the 77th Treasury Secretary. This is your first sit-down interview since taking over as that spot, Mr. Secretary, and I want to thank you very, very much for joining us and inviting us in.
Thank you for being here.
As Joe mentioned, there are a lot of questions that people want to hear from you. There's been huge debate about some of these issues, and one thing that I'd like to clear up first and foremost is how you pronounce your name, because I've heard it pronounced 15 different ways by people who swear they know your family. Mnuchin?
I'll go with Mnuchin.
Okay, Stephen Mnuchin, just for the record,
exactly.
So we clear it up and we get it right on our air
Stephen,
from here.
Not Steve.
Stephen Mnuchin, just so people know this, because we have butchered it at a few times through here. You know, so the thing that I think is most important to the markets is what's happening with tax reform. Yesterday, President Trump said that we could expect to see a plan maybe the beginning to middle of March. He said it's very well finalized at this point. I just wonder, does it resemble the House plan? What can you tell us about the plan at this point?
Well, let me first say that our economic agenda, the number one issue is growth, and the first most important thing that will impact growth is a tax plan. So we are committed to pass tax reform. It will be very significant. It's going to be focused on middle-income tax cuts, simplification, and making the business tax competitive with the rest of the world, which has been a big problem and a lot of reason why companies are leaving and cash is sitting offshore. So that's really our focus. We want to get this done by the August recess. We've been working closely with the leadership in the House and the Senate, and we're working on a combined plan.
Great. Let's break down some of the specifics that you just mentioned. Growth being the most important part, you have talked about how you think we can get back to 3% GDP, maybe better than that. How do we do that?
I do. I think it's very achievable. I think if you look at long-term growth, we have underperformed where we need to be. And we believe that we can be competitive and get back to sustainable growth of 3% or more. And there's going to be a lot of things that will impact it. I think the first issue, as I mentioned, is going to be tax reform. I think the other issue is going to be regulatory relief. We need to cut back regulations that have prevented small and medium-sized businesses from being the engine of growth in this country. And we're also focused, as you know, on Dodd-Frank and looking at Dodd-Frank and making sure that banks can lend. There's an incredible amount of liquidity out there, and we want to make sure that banks put it to work.
If we stick to your time frame and we see something passed before the August recess, do you think we've already seen regulatory reform start? Do you think that we would see 3% plus GDP by next year?
I think it's going to take time to get there. So I think it would be, you know, more towards the end, seeing the growth towards the end of next year. I think by the time we pass tax reform, you see the impact on the economy, you see the impact of regulation. It's definitely going to take into next year to see an engine of growth.
Obviously, a lot of people are looking at this, the Fed and the CBO, and their growth projections are closer to 1.8%. What are they missing? They don't see any of this?
I don't think they're missing anything. I think they're making those projections based on the status quo. And that's where the economy has been. It's been actually lower than that under the Obama administration. And I think we're looking at significant economic changes. We have an unbelievable economic team. Myself, Gary Cohn, I speak to Gary many times a day. We were with Mick Mulvaney yesterday on the budget at OMB. We got Wilbur Ross in commerce. You know, we have a great economic team, and we're going to put forth policies that are going to really create growth in this country.
Let's talk about how you get a plan through Congress, because the House has its plan that Paul Ryan has shepherded that a lot of people understand very well. But there have been a number of Republican senators, I can name at least six, who have said that the idea of a border adjustment tax is something that is dead on arrival, that they will not support. That makes up a huge portion, $1 trillion in income. First of all, do you agree with the border adjustment tax as something that you think needs to be involved in tax reform?
Well, let me just say, I think that there is a consensus on the majority of where we are on tax reform. Mm-hmm. We're looking closely at the issues on the border adjusted tax. I've spoken extensively with Paul Ryan mm-hmm. and with Chairman Brady on this, and we're looking at it. We think there's some very interesting aspects of it. We think there's some concerns about it. But I think one of the things, you know, we are all committed to do is make sure there is a combined plan that is a plan that is the administration's plan with the support of the House and the Senate, that we're all working together on one plan that gets passed. And I think everybody's on the same page in doing that.
The business community obviously is looking very closely at a lot of these issues. You have major exporters like a Boeing or a General Electric who are adamant that we see some sort of a border adjustment, if not that sort of a tax, but some other way of making the adjustment, because, as they point out, American manufacturers are at a huge disadvantage. We're the only one of 35 OECD countries that don't do something like that. But if you hear from the big retailers, somebody like a Walmart or Target, they say it would wipe out their profits potentially and would end up being a tax on consumers. Which one of those two camps do you kind of have your own concerns coming in more closely aligned?
Well, let me just say, one of the things we're doing is we're reaching out to business, not mm-hmm. just big business, but small and medium-sized businesses also, and we're listening to what people have to say. Matter of fact, this morning, the president is hosting a group. I think we have about 30 executives from various different manufacturers. I'll be going over to the White House and participating in that. The president has already hosted the retail group. So we're listening. We understand the concerns. We understand where people are, and we're going to have a plan that addresses these concerns.
It's fair to say that it's still a little too early to tell on some of these details, that has to be worked out?
I would say it's a little too early to announce. So we're working behind the scenes very carefully. We're running a lot of numbers, and we're taking into account a lot of issues. And as I said, you know, you're going to see something in the near future, and we're committed to get this passed by August.
Does this plan need to be revenue neutral?
Well, I think one of the issues when you talk about revenue neutral, there's going to be the scoring that the Joint Committee uses, and then there's going to be our own internal views at Treasury and the administration. And my guess is that our growth assumptions will be higher than what they use to score the plan. So again, these are the types of things we're looking at. We're running a lot of numbers. I think you've heard me talk about we believe in dynamic, not static scoring. I think that's something that's very important. And the great thing, I mean, I'll tell you, my first week in Treasury, I heard a lot about the incredible resources in this building. I mean, there's obviously an incredible history here, but I mean, they're just unbelievable resources. The staff is so talented. They are so focused on doing things. And we have over 100 people in the tax group in a modeling area, and they're working around the clock on running scenarios for us.
You know, it's a fair point. If you're using dynamic scoring, which is obviously if growth is coming in faster than expected, that's going to change all of the different numbers. But it always gets back to the question of who gets to be the arbiter of that, who's calling the shots, who's making those decisions. Just to be clear, what you're saying is that you'll have your own internal scoring of all of this. It won't necessarily be something that matches up with CBO or another way of looking at things?
Well, again, there may be differences in growth projections.
Right.
And I think you've seen that in the past. I think, as we've talked about, you know, we have growth projections based upon our plan that we think we're going to create significant amounts of growth. And that's going to create jobs. That's going to create tax revenues. That's going to stimulate the economy. So we got a lot of people doing a lot of work. And as I said, this is my number one agenda item. The president is very focused on this. The leadership is very focused on this. And we're going to get this done.
You mentioned that you're making sure that this is going to bring tax breaks to middle-class Americans. When you sat down with us on Squawk Box back in November, you said that even if wealthier people get a tax break, it's not going to be that they necessarily are paying less in taxes because the deductions, the loopholes, will be closed as a result. Do you stand by that now that you're actually in the administration and in your position as Treasury Secretary?
There's been a lot of comments on that. And I actually think there's a rule. I think during my confirmation, it got named the Mnuchin rule. So I was very keen on now there's a Volcker rule and a Mnuchin rule and a Buffett rule. So I feel like I have good company. Right. Look, as I've said before, we're primarily focused on a middle income tax cut and simplification for business. And what we are focused is that on the high end, if there are tax cuts, that they are offset with reduction of deductions and other things. So it's something we're going to carefully look at. And when we come out with the plan, we'll come obviously out with the distribution and how it impacts people. And that's something we're very focused on.
Does that mean that the Mnuchin rule is not set in stone at this point, that it's debatable?
Well, again, we haven't finalized the plan, but our objective and what I said before still stands. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of the devil is in the details when we run the numbers. But the objective is this is a middle income tax cut, and this is tax simplification, and this is making businesses more competitive.
There have been a lot of questions about what the timing would be on this. Do you expect that the tax reforms would be retroactive to take place in January of this year, or do you expect that this is something that we would look for next year at the earliest?
Again, I can't comment on the specifics of when we roll this out. Obviously, those are the types of things that we'll be taking into account. Regardless of when they go in place, this won't really impact the economy until next year when you begin to see changes in behavior. Mm-hmm. And it will take a couple of years to get growth, but we're committed in this administration. And you can see this in the markets. You can see the stock markets up. You can see the dollars up. You know, there's a lot of confidence in the Trump administration and in the desire to invest in the U.S. This is a very competitive place to do business. We got great companies, and you see that reflected in the markets.
Obviously, the stock market has rallied significantly since President Trump took office, and actually since the election, and then again since he took office. Do you view that as a report card
Absolutely.
For the administration?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a mark-to-market business, and you see what the market thinks.
If the market were to pull back, is that just disappointment in things not getting done as quickly as market had anticipated? Or do you just expect, you've watched the markets for a long time, do you expect a pullback at some point when you see things move so far so quickly?
Well, look, I've always been focused in the markets on not day trading and where they are day to day. So whether the market goes up or down on any given day, you know, I've given up figuring out why that is.
Smart man.
So, you know, but do I think that, you know, over the course of the year, we're in an environment where there's very attractive investment opportunities in the U.S., and I think that's reflective of the administration's goals and what the market thinks of it.
You have said that you expect interest rates to remain relatively low for some period of time, but when we get to this growth that you're expecting of 3% or better, how quickly do you think interest rates will have to adjust to catch up with that, to reflect a strong economy?
Well, let me say this is really more the Fed's role and not my role. And I do look forward. I'm starting my weekly meetings with Janet Yellen at the Fed, and I look forward to spending time with her. You know, I would just comment again, we're in an environment where we are at historically low interest rates. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at this on a historical basis, we will probably have low interest rates for a long period of time. That doesn't mean that they're within that. There's not the context that interest rates can go up, and you've seen the Fed signal that. So again, I'm not going to speculate on what they're going to do, but my comments are really about where we are, not relative to just today, but where we are relative to where interest rates have been over a long period of time.
There were some market speculation yesterday that you might today announce plans for a longer-term Treasury bond, a 50-year and a 100-year bond, because of just that, interest rates being low right now. Have you given that serious thought, and is that something we should expect to see a rollout?
Well, I've said this before. I mean, we're not going to make a formal, we're not ready to make any formal announcement on whether we are going to have a 50-year or a 100-year. But I have said this before. I think it's something that we should seriously look at. I've already begun to talk to the staff about looking at that. Again, we'll reach out to the market, investors, different people. But I think it's something that is a very serious issue of whether we should explore, whether we can raise 50 or 100-year money at a very slight premium. Mm. That's something that makes sense for Treasury to look at.
Yeah, it does. Yesterday, you contacted Christine Lagarde at the IMF and had some conversations with her about making sure the IMF is policing the currency exchange rate policies of its members. Is that a way of trying to monitor China and make sure that they're treating things fairly without officially calling them currency manipulators?
Well, let me first say I had a terrific conversation with her. I think I've spoken to probably about 12 foreign leaders at this point, finance ministers and different people in the governments. So I think I have the rest of my call scheduled for next week. I'm looking forward to going to the G20 in Baden-Baden in March. So I think one of the important jobs in this parts of the role is to make sure that I reach out to my counterparts and that we're focused on creating objectives that will create economic growth for us and sustained economic growth throughout the world. And we've talked about this. Currencies are one of the things we look at. And that's something I've talked to a lot of my counterparts about.
Is it fair to say that you're not going to be naming China a currency manipulator anytime soon?
Again, what it's fair to say is, first of all, I've had a terrific conversation with my counterparts there. I look forward to meeting them. We have a process within Treasury where we go through and look at currency manipulation across the board, and we'll go through that process. So we'll do that as we have in the past, and we're not making any judgments until we continue that process.
Do you have any thoughts on the Ex-Im Bank, the Export-Import Bank? It's something that big exporters in the United States have hoped to see some support for. I don't know what your thoughts are on it.
I've talked to the president about it. It's something we're looking at. It's obviously stalled at the moment. I think there's a lot of concerns historically about the Ex-Im Bank, and is it just subsidizing certain large corporations? Mm-hmm. And that's not something we're interested in doing. On the other hand, we're going to take a serious look at, and to the extent that we think the Export-Import Bank can be competitive in helping mm-hmm. small and medium-sized businesses export, that's something that's important. So I think, as you know, right now we have a situation where they can make loans up to $10 million.
Right.
They're doing that. They're doing plenty of them. And I already have a team looking at what the impact is on the economy if we expanded that.
Fannie and Freddie, it's been a huge issue that people have kind of been swirling around. It's hard to say exactly where the administration stands on it, but you have been committed to housing finance reform. Can you tell us how you come down on that and what sort of time frame we should expect?
Sure. So, I mean, I'd say, again, something I've already started working on. I met with Mel Watt this week. We had a very good conversation. I've met with Jeb Hensarling. We've talked about the various different issues. So, again, I think, as I've said before, I'm committed that under this administration, we're going to have housing reform so that we don't just leave these entities the way they are. They've been sitting there for too long of a period of time, and we need a solution. And we're going to look at this. I think this will be one of the areas where hopefully we will have a bipartisan solution. I think there's a lot of people that share the view that we need to do something with them. There are different views. As I said, you know, I've already reached out to people. We have a team internally that we've already assigned. So this is something we're going to study carefully. So I don't think you're going to see something right away from us, whereas tax reform is a near-term issue. But this is definitely on the agenda. You know, we got a lot of things to do here. I mean, there's housing reform, there's cybersecurity. I spent a lot of time on technology. It's a big priority for me to make sure, whether it's the IRS, that we protect people's records. We got to update the systems at the IRS. We need to make sure that the banking infrastructure is safe. So, you know, there's a lot of things on my to-do list.
Yeah, obviously, you have a huge to-do list. You have a very busy day. I want to thank you for your time. But before we let you go, have you been working on your signature for the
I have dollar? Indeed. I have indeed. My signature was great before because nobody could ever copy it.
Yeah, it was a lot of loops.
But I was actually at a dinner, and everybody at the dinner, like, signed the menu and passed it around. And someone said to me, whose signature is this? And I realized it was mine, that nobody could read it. So my kids and others have encouraged me to have a new signature. So I've been practicing it, so it'll be nice and neat on the money.
Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, interviewed by Becky Quick of CNBC. Max Armstrong joins us on The Markets, brought to you by the CME Group, after this.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need, today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Welcome back to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. I'm Steve Alexander, in for Orion Samuelson, and look who's here. It's our buddy Max Armstrong.
With us this weekend to talk about the market situation, specifically as it relates to grains, is Jerry Goodell from Price Group. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you, Max. Always good to be here.
Oh, I see you're ready for this season to have your Cubs tie on.
Yes, exactly.
You're not one of those bandwagon guys either, are you?
No, I've been a season ticket holder since the mid-'80s, so I've been here a long time waiting for this.
You put up with a lot of years.
And I'm planning on celebrating all the way to the 4th of July. Then we'll have to see.
Above the stats that you watch for baseball are those for the grains. Supply and demand. What about those acreage numbers that came out this week? Was there anything striking about those numbers plugged in, those assumptions being made by USDA?
Yes, you know, this is not a survey of the producers. This is really assumptions that they're looking at. They put out some of these as a baseline number, but they readjusted them today because we had a big adjustment in last fall's winter wheat plantings. They were 1.5 to 2 million less than they were anticipating in November. And the numbers we had in January, and that factor then made adjustments in the soybeans. The soybeans went from about 85.5 up to about 88 million in their this week's numbers, and it's a significant increase, but yet in the same situation, the trade was looking for numbers similar to that, and at this point, the corn number, also in the U.S., was placed at 90 million, which is down about 4 million from last year.
There was the expectation that the soybean acreage would rise a little bit. Was there that idea?
There's whisper campaigns and ideas earlier there that we could be as high as 5 or 6 million.
I mean, we've heard talk of 90 million acres.
Definitely, definitely. And that came from some very respected sources of surveying people. But I think what's happened even in the last 6 to 8 weeks, that the corn prices has crept back towards $4 for new crop, and soybean prices have plateaued after the emotions of Argentina. And so they're coming back a little bit closer to each other. And also the Eastern Corn Belt, tough for people to not plant corn when you get 200 bushels.
And the yields were superb last year.
Yes.
But let the record show, bean yields were surprising for many as well.
They were off the charts. If you think about it, 4.5 bushels jump year over year. But I think in reality is that the soybeans area could still go up a little bit. We still got to shake some things out in the northern plains, how this wheat numbers come out from there. And also what happens in the southwest where we've got less corn acres down there and maybe less sorghum might be going to cotton.
And let us not forget, as you pointed out, this is not an actual producer survey. The intentions report will come out next month.
Yes, March 31st is when we'll get the first indications from producers how they're looking at it. And we've also heard and seen about early planning scenarios here because of the excellent weather we've had around the Midwest in the last 5 to 7 days. It's prompting people to get out there and get some spring work done.
We've seen a lot of social media images. We've heard reports. We've seen farmers out there in the field doing tillage work, applying anhydrous ammonia, even limbering up some planters well ahead of when they should be in those particular areas. Is the market assuming at this point it will be an early start to planting and perhaps a quick planting season?
I think that's the general expectation, of course, considering where we're at. We still could have some maybe delays in weather in March and early April, but the thing is, it's black out there. People are going to be able to make up time pretty quickly. I don't see we're going to have any major delays here in the basic Midwest. One area of concern continues to be the northern plains because of the snows we had up there, and that could have some influences, but in the heart of the Midwest, no.
And there have even been some logistics problems there in terms of moving grain out of the northern plains. Correct?
Exactly. The snows have retreated up there a little bit, but the interesting part is that they're getting through the mountains and through the Rockies and the Sierras to get that grain to Portland and Seattle has been very slow. And we've actually had some delays, and our shipment patterns have been delayed a little bit. I think that was going to get overtaken, and we'll be in good shape. But it's a little bit of a concern in the short term.
Mexico, how much of a concern? We've seen a lot of press here of late about how worrisome that should be, yet I don't sense a huge amount of worry on the part of farmers about losing a significant market. And Mexico needs our corn, don't they, Jerry, for goodness sake?
They do. And the price advantage of taking corn from the Midwest and railing it into the areas that need it is still a 40 to 60 cent advantage for the U.S. But I think the Mexicans in their own way are also creating some of this for their own thing as a way of trying to remind the present administration that it's a two-way street. If you're going to knock us on manufacturing, our best alternative is looking at agricultural scenarios. And I hope that our new Secretary of Agriculture makes that point with the administration about how important this is across all areas of U.S. agriculture, not grains, take meats, take grapes, everything out there. It's highly important that we do not have retaliatory issues.
We need him on the job, what you're saying, the Ag Secretary.
Yes, it would be good to get him nominated or actually on board.
If there is a little bit of reduction of some sort of our shipments of corn into Mexico, if there is some action that reduces them even a little bit, could the emotional response in the marketplace be more significant than the actual cutback?
Totally. We've had that same issue of having some beans come in from the South America and having influences of knocking the price down. It might not be a significant total, but this idea of having 500,000 metric tons of more corn coming from Argentina into Mexico could still have some emotional reaction to the actual price.
Emotional reactions seem to be quick, and sometimes there can be a quick bounce back, a quick shift after that emotional reaction. Is that something farmers ought to be thinking about?
Oh, definitely. But I think it's important that people take advantage of the prices that are out here right now. Think if you're expanding beans out there, by the way, be sure to sell some of those beans. These are $10 new crop prices out there. Don't forget that it's always highly important to get some fall sales done.
Jerry Goodell from Price Group with us this weekend.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need. Today, and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
You're listening to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. And before we wrap it up today, let's look at commodities. Crude oil dropped about 1% on Friday as worries about rising U.S. supplies outweighed the pledge from OPEC nations that they will cut production. West Texas tea futures dropped about 46 cents at $53.99 a barrel. Brent crude settled 59 cents lower at $55.99 a barrel, but both benchmarks notched a weekly gain of about 1.1%. At the Chicago Board of Trade, corn fell to a 2.5-week low on fund long liquidation and lower than expected weekly export sales. March corn was down 1.5 cents at $3.64 per bushel. During the session, it got down to $3.62.5. the lowest since February 7th. For the week, the corn contract fell 4.25 cents, or 1.2%. March soybeans settled about 2 cents higher at 10.13.5 a bushel. For the week, beans were down 19 cents a bushel, or 1.8%, the second consecutive weekly decline. Wheat futures at the Chicago Board of Trade closed lower on Friday on technical selling and plentiful global supplies. March wheat was down 6.75 cents at 4.31.25. For the week, wheat was down 9.75 cents, or 2.2%. I thank you for listening to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. For Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong, I'm Steve Alexander.